and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 24th of October. It's the end of the month, and joining me is assistant editor Steve Withers.
That's a fake laugh.
Audio reviewer Ed Selly.
This dumb tree is also my friend.
And special guest Mark Potwright.
I don't know how this machine works.
Welcome back to the AV Forums podcast and Gardens of the Galaxy, as I like to call it, Volume 2. The teaser trailer arrived this week. Everybody seen it?
Yes.
No, I haven't got around to that.
It's 2 minutes.
Ed. Literally 2 minutes.
One thing for this podcast.
I'll probably go and see it. I'm sure it's very, do you know what? As I say, obviously, we've established over the last many weeks, I have a different attitude towards trailers than you. But I think that based on the first Guardians of the Galaxy film, which I enjoyed very much, I'll go and see it. Don't need to see the trailer. Be fine.
Okay. Well, if we're keeping it short and sweet, it looks like more of the same.
Yes, it does. Which is not a bad thing, is it? I mean, I enjoyed the first one immensely. So.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the if that'll still be the case for the second one. You know, because the first one was a bit novel, a bit different. If it's just more of the same, then is it going to be as good?
I think the fact that they cast Kurt Russell in the film means it has to be good, because Kurt Russell's a god, therefore. Might even be playing a god, actually. Who knows?
Well, I think they built the characters kind of into strong enough figures that I think people would accept more of the same, wouldn't they? I mean, most people left the first film wanting more. I think even if it falls down and ends up being very formulaic, I still think that will please people.
Okay, so I guess amongst all four of us here, we're as excited as we can be.
Based on a 1 minute, 50-second clip.
Excited as you can be on a Friday morning after the fourth attempt at a Skype call. Yes.
Current competitions, we forgot to do it last week. So there's lots to go through, and I think I'll get our guest, Mark Botwright, to do this one.
Yep, we've got 3 copies of The Lion in Winter on Blu-ray. That one's open to all members till the 26th of October. We've also got a pair of tickets to see Ed Harris on stage in Buried Child. That's open to all members as well till the 27th of October. There's a copy of the Blu-ray and the autobiography of The Governor, open to all members till 31st of October. 3 copies of Level Up on Blu-ray. That one's open as well to all members till the 31st of October. 3 copies of Gods of Egypt on 3D Blu-ray. Again, all members till the 2nd of November this time. And 3 copies of Lucifer Season 1 on DVD. Ooh, old-fashioned. And to open till 9th of November to all members.
Yeah, I just realised there was a DVD in there. How did that sneak in there?
It's not available on Blu-ray.
Right, okay, well, that makes sense then. Previous competition winners, Mark?
Rog69, nice, won the Steliers Audio ML30HD amplifier. Red Bull Master won the Steliers Audio NS3 active speakers. And Mella won the Steliers Audio NS1 active speakers.
Well done to everybody that won there. And we're going to have quite a few competition winners going forward with the amount of competitions that are going up on the site. So keep your eyes peeled and get entering, because you never know. You have to be in it to win it. Let's move on to hardware news. And THX have been sold to Razer. Now, I have to put my hands up here and admit that I didn't know who the hell Razer was until I read the press release. But seemingly they're a gaming company, Mark.
Yes, they very much specialize in kind of PC gaming peripherals, mice, keyboards, headsets, that kind of thing, very much tailored towards the serious gamers. You know, you see a lot of stuff like mouse mats and stuff like that, which you wouldn't ordinarily associate with an idea that it could be an upgrade for gaming. But if it is, they'll sell it. So as they're very kind of big in things like headsets, then this definitely makes sense for them.
Yeah, and according to the press release, Steve, THX staying the same, staying as an independent company, keeping the same staff on board. So it doesn't look like there's going to be any major changes here, just a big change in shareholder.
Yeah, I mean, who were they owned by before? Because Lucasfilm divested them some years ago.
Yeah, it was an investor group. So a lot of people think it was Creative, but Creative was only one of the companies within this investor group, so they didn't have any outright ownership. So it was an investment group that had them after Lucasfilm.
has THX really been a big force in the AV world of late? You know, back in the old days when they were doing things like the certification programs for cinemas, and then obviously they did big things in terms of home video in the early days, in the late 80s, early 90s. They were owned by Lucasfilm. They were a project that was set up by George Lucas. They had a certain cachet attached to that. I think that the AV world has moved on considerably since then, and their importance has diminished over time. And I would say that these days, in terms of AV, in terms of particularly high-end AV, you don't see the THX name as much as you used to. I mean, Panasonic still use it to a degree, DX902 and the UB900, both THX certified, but it's something that you see less and less. And I question whether it's that relevant anymore. And so, you know, it's an interesting news story, but I don't think it's going to have a particularly big impact on the AV world.
The problem for me was it started to dilute when they started to water it down and move it into other areas other than high-end AV. So when they started certifying things like speakers for computers and sound bars and you know, areas of the market where you didn't need a minimum set of standards, it then didn't start to make much sense for me, and it became too much of a corporate commercial thing, and it lost its kudos. I mean, the kudos with THX was it was always about quality control, about hitting certain standards, and when you're talking about that, you're talking mid-level to high-level and high-end AV kit, and that's where it lost its kudos when it became too diluted. And then for whatever reason, I think there was lots and lots of changes of personnel and all the rest of it within the company over a number of years, and they kind of lost focus of where they were going with things and trying to expand out into other areas like developing speakers and amplifiers under their own name and that kind of thing, which wasn't what THX was all about. THX was about certification and about standards and about education. And for me, they lost their way quite a bit going back a few years ago. And it's going to take a lot to turn it around, and I don't think they can turn it around. I think, like you say, the industry's moved on. The minimum standards now and the minimum level of what equipment can do is vastly improved over where we were 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, you know, the level of kit, the level of build quality, the actual performance that we can get from stuff now is way and above what THX was certifying anyway. Do you see any relevance anymore, Ed?
Well, they certainly didn't do themselves any favours. I mean, to give a specific example of how they annoyed manufacturers, I, you know, many years ago was working for Cambridge Audio and Mordant Short, and we went to the effort of getting one of the packs of speakers, the 500 series, THX certified. And we went through the THX Select program, and it was grueling, and it cost a lot of money. You were continuously sending stuff backwards and forwards to the United States. They didn't always return the stuff that didn't pass. Within 6 months of us passing those select standards, they then, just extending on what you were saying about all of a sudden then other stuff started appearing with THX certification, they essentially tossed those out the window and without really then changing the THX select badging. And that, you know, from our perspective, we didn't, you know, once that's happened, we didn't want to do it again.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're all for certain standards. We're all for equipment reaching certain standards. And it used to be a badge that when you saw it on equipment, you knew it might not be the best in that area, but it certainly had reached a certain standard, Steve.
Yeah.
And you could expect a certain level of performance from a bit of kit, which was, you know, back then, I would say it's not the same as it is today. I think today stuff is so similar. I mean, I've got a Den in it at the minute, and I use a Yamaha, and I've got another Yamaha in it at the minute. And to be honest, it's difficult telling which brand is which now because they all sound so similar. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, they actually sound absolutely brilliant, but there's none of this. There's not a big difference between brands now because they all reach a certain standard.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking only last week about the impressive level of quality you could get from a sub-£1,000 projector. I've seen a number of quite cheap TVs recently from Hisense, for example, that have delivered a really great performance for the money. So you're right, there is definitely, I think maybe we could say THX has achieved its goal. It was set up to improve the standards of performance in cinemas originally, because Lucas looked at what was happening and thought this is terrible. I believe that's definitely improved over the, I mean, I can say for a fact that in the last 20 to 30 years, cinema presentation, I mean, people still moan about cinema presentation, but it is so much better than it used to be. I mean, we can remember the days when prints were scratched to buggery and, you know, bulbs never changed and everything. I think the level of, thanks to, again, George Lucas and digital projection and things like that, cinemas are much better. So they've done that effectively. And in terms of domestic and home AV, like you say, Phil, the level of performance you can get now for even an insignificant amount of money is quite staggering. The manufacturers have all upped their game. Everyone's delivering really high quality products, I think, across the board. And in general, the performance you're getting now is streets ahead of anything you could have got spending $100,000 15 years ago, for example. You could probably get that performance for less than 10 now. So maybe again, their goal's been achieved and technology has sort of outstripped their real the need for THX in a way. So that's one factor. And as you say, both you and both Phil and Ed have said, you know, to a certain extent, the brand's value has been diminished since it was sold off by Lucasfilm. And it stopped just being about standard, because back then it wasn't really a profit organization. It was there to improve the standards of products, both domestically and professionally. And once it was about making money, then you have no choice but to do certain things, because you've got to make a profit. And unfortunately, I think they've diminished the value of the brand doing that. And I think that we live in a different world now, and probably THX will gradually disappear.
I mean, it's possible, if I was going to be trying to strike a note of optimism, the Ultra Standard and Ultra 2, they never diluted to quite, well, really anything like the same extent. They remained pretty significant badges to actually achieve. I suppose if you really wanted to try and, you know, do something meaningful, you know, perhaps if you established Ultra 3 as an unattainable gold standard, that just tied what we're shooting for in picture, what we're shooting for in terms of, you know, format handling, and we just tied it all together in a neat but really very elite level certification. You know, that could, I suppose, give something for manufacturers to shoot for and be of, you know, some relevance to the consumer. But that's about it.
Just a couple of points there. So I think you're right, Steve. I think when it stopped becoming Lucasfilm THX, it lost a lot of kudos. It lost a lot of the appeal, because the appeal there was, I don't know if you remember the old THX WOW Laserdisc and so on, where it was all Indiana Jones and Star Wars and all the rest of it cut together, you know, Lucasfilm stuff cut together to give a sound demonstration and all the rest of it. You had Pixar doing the trailers for the cinemas, so if you were in a THX certified cinema, you had Pixar trailers done with THX text and all the rest of it. And like you say, as soon as it was sold off, it had to start making money, it had to start turning a profit. That's where they had to then start moving the goalpost. And to be honest with you, Ed, I agree totally with you. What I think they should do is get rid of Select and Select 2 and computers and all the rest. Get rid of all that certification, because it's meaningless, and just have a gold standard award for equipment that really does hit a benchmark. And that's going to be high-end kit, but at the end of the day, you know, that's where you expect benchmark stuff to be, at the higher end of the market, where it's proven to work together. And I've got some benchmark stuff in here which we've had for review. I mean, the M&K speakers, they're Ultra 2, and there's no cost spared with them in terms of their development costs and all the rest of it. But yeah, I mean, and like Steve said, it's a lot of the higher end stuff that now carries the THX badge, like the Panasonic gear, like their player and so on, and the new 4K badging. I think if they keep it at that, there's still some life, but they definitely need to diversify their business. But I think the certification game is not the way to do it, because if you dilute it too far, which I think they've already done, it becomes worthless, it becomes meaningless.
Yeah, I'll drink to that. Well, I'll drink to most things, but I think that's a pretty sound evaluation.
Yeah, and I've got to say, I really like THX. I've always found THX to be a really approachable company. They've always had the same sort of ethos and goals that we have at AV Forums, which is education and doing things the right way to get the absolute best out of your kit and setting your stuff up and so on. So I really like THX. I really like their ethos. It's just when it comes to the business side of things. And as you say, Steve, it's a bit unfortunate that they have had to dilute things because they have to make a profit these days. It'd be nice if somebody just came along and financed them as a standards body.
Yeah. I mean, I think they've been enormously successful in terms of their initial goals, because remember when you mentioned Laserdisc and they were THX certified, DVDs came along and they were THX certified. Some Blu-rays, but not that many. you look at the quality of disc transfers now on Blu-ray and Ultra HD Blu-ray, and pretty much across the board now, the studios are really delivering top-notch, transfers. And so that message is obviously filtered down to the studios. You've got people like Dolby Atmos, Dolby with their Atmos platform, and DTS with DTSX, and they're upping their game in terms of delivering immersive audio. So the companies that worked with THX in the early days have obviously learned from that, have taken that ethos forward. And I think, your average home cinema fan now is getting a stupendous level of performance and quality. And we can, a lot of that can go back to the days of THX. So we certainly should be grateful for the work they did put in over, from the mid 80s through to the end of the 90s. That was the important time when things were changing and developing, and they really did do a fantastic job, and we're still reaping the benefits now.
So, Mark, what kind of things do you see them doing with Razer then? Because obviously they're not going to invest in them for nothing.
I think perhaps there's scope for the headset market with regards VR, where you're going to have some confusion over 3D audio standards and things like that. Perhaps they can kind of create some kind of certification for that, or perhaps it's just a case of using the badge and trying to find some way to kind of tie that in. But that's going to be a fairly big market, and for the price point as well, they'll want to seem like a premium product. Razer products aren't generally cheap, and they are well made and kind of cater towards those more at the kind of more dedicated serious end of the market. But again, it's a question about kind of getting some kind of standards across the board, and so maybe that'll play into it.
Okay, so let's stay with you and moving on to news of Nintendo nature, which I understand you're a bit of a Nintendo fan, Mark. So obviously you're going to appreciate this news that came out about Switch, which used to be a Will Smith thing, wasn't it? He used to do the old Switch. Nintendo Switch.
Tumbleweed. I should kind of preface this by saying, yes, I'm a Nintendo fan, but I have skipped the occasional console. I didn't buy the Virtual Boy. And I think there was one variant of the Game Boy Advance I never owned. But, Nintendo released a very short, kind of 3-minute advertising, early kind of marketing viral style trailer, and it looks basically like all the leaks beforehand said it would do, which is it's a tablet style portable with two little detachable controllers on either side called the Joy-Cons. They always have to come up with a name, and it seems like very much they're trying to rectify the mistakes of the Wii U. So things like, whereas the Wii U was sold with the idea of the portability of the gamepad controller, ultimately you couldn't take it away from the console very far. And if you lived particularly in kind of a British home or one with thicker walls or that kind of thing, there were a lot of people complaining they could barely get to the next room with it. It was literally a case of you either sit at your sofa playing on the screen in front of you, or you sit on the sofa playing on the tablet in front of you. There wasn't that much mobility. So the fact that this has the processing within it and is kind of separating that, kind of almost inverting the process by then having a dock, which you then put it into to then play it on the big screen, seems like it could sell. And if you consider also Nintendo's market is so heavily skewed towards handheld, I mean, there are kind of question marks over how fast that's hemorrhaging as well and how much that's being kind of eaten up by smartphone and tablets, but still they sold good amounts of the 3DS. You can make a decent case that in fact in each generation they've sold a decent amount of hardware. It's just it has been heavily skewed towards the handheld in recent times. Now if they can get their message across that this isn't a kind of underpowered home console, but instead it's a very powerful handheld, then that will definitely sell. I think pricing point, there are question marks over cooling, battery life, things like that, how well it might scale to your TV's resolution, all those kind of things. But ultimately, it sells because of things like the games shown during the trailer, which the idea that you can play the latest Zelda and have it be at least Nintendo console quality graphics and be playing that on the go. I don't much care for some of the examples given in the advertising material, but still the point remains that you can take it on the go. It's very much designed to be adaptable. They've tried to kind of push this idea that you can use the little Joy-Cons for local multiplayer, but I don't really see anyone kind of sitting hunched over a 6-inch screen playing that in split screen on a controller that's kind of smaller than a packet of cigarettes or anything. But they have to kind of show that this is in some way adaptable. And if they can get the messaging right and if they can get the price right, then yeah, it will definitely sell.
I did watch some. I looked at this. I think it's quite an intriguing looking device, I have to say. And I think, and I don't know if Mark agrees, I think it makes perfect sense that, you know, Nintendo has stepped out of the horsepower game of, you know, absolute console power, because it just is not going to be one that they compete against Sony and Microsoft in terribly successfully. And if it plays to their strengths, and I suppose like anything, if the games are good as well, I hope it'll be quite good.
Yeah, a question of if the games are good. For a long time, Nintendo has been that kind of secondary system to people. You buy it because you like Nintendo games. Now, with regards their handheld consoles, at least there's a differentiating factor, which is other players have tried to join that market. Sony kind of left the PSP and the Vita to kind of atrophy, in much the same way you could argue Nintendo have done with their home consoles. But there are different developers who support that, and there's a particular style of game that tends to pop up on handhelds. The only issue perhaps will be, as you get more powerful handhelds, the inclination becomes more and more just to kind of replicate the home console experience on a handheld. And I'm not fully sure whether, in fact, the market that's there for handheld portable gaming would really transfer to the idea of having console style games on the handheld as much as they might be those people who are in fact filtering more towards smartphone gaming. So all those kind of casuals who joined early on with things like the DS, have they in fact stayed in the same general kind of sphere of preferring simplistic titles, you know, your kind of visual novels, stuff like that, puzzle games, on smartphones and on tablets, which is just a kind of more digestible form. It all really comes down to whether Nintendo can get a decent stream of games out at launch and going forwards. You know, they're already using the kind of term launch window, launch period. I don't really like that, because, you know, I'm one of those people. I've got a Wii U. I like my Wii U. I've got lots of games for it, but I'm still waiting for the Zelda title that I was promised in 2015. You know, there's a habit of these delays. Now, what this does really do, I mean, if you see it less as just a kind of hyper-powered handheld and more as Nintendo trying to tie together handheld and home console development, it means that you don't have to double up on things. You don't have to have, you know, a series of development studios who are putting out similar titles on a handheld and on a home console and trying to kind of, you know, do them almost in unison, when that's a huge amount of wasted energy to put out, say, a Mario Kart on a 3DS and a Mario Kart on a Wii U, when you could be just unifying it all in one box. And if they can manage to do that, if they can kind of channel all that energy in one direction, then it should mean hopefully that things like the shortages in the release schedule and the fact that they won't ultimately have the kind of huge third-party support that people recognise from Western developers that the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One have, it should mean it'll be a kind of more palatable option, that you'll have that steady stream of content going forwards.
I got to say, I saw the advert and I thought it was a really clever idea. I mean, I've got no interest in it personally. But I guess if you are a Nintendo fan, if you do want to game on the move as well as at home, and as you say, Mark, if it kind of dovetails the two sides of their business into one, then it makes sense. And it certainly looks clever. And I kind of like the idea behind it. But obviously, it's not my cup of tea. Although if I might digress for a second on a gaming related subject, something that I've been poo-pooing for about the last 5 years, I finally got my first taste of last night. I went to my friend's house and had a go on his PSVR. Amazing. I got home last night and bought one. It was an incredible experience. I really, really enjoyed it. It was it's sitting in a dive cage being lowered into the ocean. And the graphics, the 3D graphics were absolutely, it was totally immersive. And a shark attacked me and you found yourself responding to stuff. You even felt like you were going down. I mean, your brain kind of fills in the gaps. And it was an amazing experience. I just thought, like, this is the kind of gaming I could get into. Really immersive gaming like this is totally, I mean, absolutely amazing. I was gobsmacked at how impressive it was. And I take back everything I've said for the last 5 years. It's the future.
Okay, so we'll be expecting a review then if you're going to have that in soon.
Well, I've got to wait about 3 weeks. It's on back order.
Anyway, so that's Nintendo. The NX has changed to the Switch, and we'll obviously be keeping an eye on this one going forward. Let's stick with Steve. Steve's got a new toy to play with, not just the VR, but Panasonic have sent through the UB700 Ultra HD Blu-ray player. Now, this is identical to the 900, apart from the drop the audio stage and THX.
Yes, it's almost identical. It looks very similar. I mean, initially, it looks identical. When you take a closer look, it isn't quite identical. As you say, there's no THX certification on this player. And at the back, there's just two HDMI outputs and an optical digital output. I mean, they've got rid of all the analog stages, which, let's be honest, I don't think most people are going to use anyway. I mean, this is kind of feels more like the player they should have put out the first time round, got the price down, delivered an Ultra HD Blu-ray player with twin HDMI outputs. That's what everyone wanted. It hasn't got the same kind of feet. The build quality isn't quite as good. It's slightly cheaper. Big disappointment is the remote control. It's got one of those stripped down, simplified Panasonic remotes, not the nice, cool one that comes with the UB900. And as far as I can tell, one of the features I really love on the UB900 is the button you can press for the, I think it's called picture info, which shows you what the disc's outputting and what the player's outputting. That button is not on the remote. You can get that screen up, by the way, using the UB900 remote on the 700, but it seems no way of accessing it with the 700 remote, which is a real shame. But otherwise, as far as I can tell, the internal architecture is the same. So the menus, the systems are the same, the output's the same, everything else appears to be identical. So if you're looking for an Ultra HD Blu-ray player, and you don't want to pay for the UB900 and you think, well, I'm not going to need all those analog outputs at the back, which you probably won't, then it certainly makes a viable alternative. And it puts it in a competitive position with the K8500, which has had a price reduction recently, the player from Samsung.
Yeah, so if it was your money, Steve, which one would you go for, the Panasonic, or would you go with the Samsung?
There are some features about the Panasonic I like. It's a bit more flexible in terms of setup, but I've got to say, I really like the Samsung. It's, you know, it's plug and play. For the average punter buying an Ultra HD Blu-ray player, you plug it in, you're off you go. I actually don't like, I quite like the design of it. I think it looks quite attractive to me. Yes, the build quality would be better, but the build quality on the Panasonic isn't as great as they make out. It's still a bit plasticky and light. And it's a great price, and it's also a really good player for watching things like Netflix and Amazon because it outputs at the correct frame rate. So I'd probably, at current prices, I'd be more tempted to go for the Samsung. I think it's a cracking little bargain.
Okay, cool. So the review of the 700 will be up later this week when you listen to this podcast. So keep your eyes out for that one. And moving over to Ed, because look out, because Thursday of this week, the 27th, the next Sound Advice is going to hit the forums. And Ed's not going to explain everything because we want you to read the article. But what's it about?
This is an entire standalone sound advice dedicated to how to set up a record player. We have, ducked in and out of which ones might be best for you and what styles might be best for you and so on and so forth. And this is slightly generalized information. Be clear on this, I say generalized, there is no way that you can have specific instructions, you can be exactingly specific in this context for everyone's different record player. This will cover the basics. They all have some commonality in terms of what you actually need to do to get them to sound at their best, but written at the top, in the biggest font I could get the content manager to deliver, it does invite you to read the manual. And I need to stress that when it comes to analog, real men and women read manuals. For God's sake, don't guess it, because it's not always self-explanatory. And unlike almost anything else we deal with in consumer electronics, if you do it wrong, you can break it irreparably. So if you take one thing from that sound advice column, it's that. But otherwise, it shows you what you're shooting for in terms of getting it level, how you need to have the arm and things like that. And hopefully it's going to be of use to you guys. As a reminder, we're the UK's largest forum. If you've got specific questions about your turntable, get them on the forum in the relevant section. And the chances are someone will come forward and give you some specific advice, maybe even a photograph or two or what they've done. So this is designed to give you an overview. And if you've got any specific questions, get into the specific forum area and get them asked. And the chances are you'll get the answer for them.
The one thing that always confused me, Ed, was anti-skip and how to set that and how to set the weighting on the arm. That always confused me. And the other thing was, obviously, I used to use SL1200's Technics. You could raise and lower the whole arm assembly as well. But there was a big black thing. I could never understand what that was for.
Well, we cover that. That's the vertical tracking angle. And the idea is that the arm has to be flat. Viewed from the side, it has to be in profile. It has to be completely level from the cartridge all the way back to the bearings, the arm assembly. And if you alter that in either direction, so the arm is either nose down or arse down, you will significantly alter the sonic presentation. Imagine the differences. You will get quite audible alterations to the frequency response if that isn't level. Anti-skate is a real magic area, because if I was to tell you that one of my arms doesn't run any anti-skate at all, it simply doesn't need it. That it's one of those areas where it will, again, very heavily depend on what record player you've bought, what arm it uses, and what cartridge. But yes, you are essentially just trying to counteract the inward force that the arm will generate as it begins to move in towards the center of the record. So yes, I've done my best to give the information which should apply equally to all turntables. If you've got any questions, throw them into the comments and I'll do what I can to get you some answers as well. Can I just say that my new record has arrived? I am unbelievably excited about this. This record is 18 years old and it has never been played. Admittedly, that's because I'm possibly the only person on earth that likes it. But, that's...
What is the record?
It's by a group called Bedlam Agogo, and it's called State Style Entertainment. And it's one of those albums which was a pretty much a commercial flop, but the influence it had across so many other artists means it's, if as I am a big fan of electronica, it's one of those ones where the influence it's had on other things is just too important not to own it in its entirety.
Okay. There you go.
Yeah. Very excited.
Learn something new every day. And on that, we're going to go from hardware over to movie news. Right, so movie news and films opening this Friday, Steve.
There's one big opening this week, and actually opens on Tuesday, not Friday. Marvel are opening it slightly earlier, presumably to boost their box office for the weekend. It's Doctor Strange, which is the latest in the entries in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And I see it's also down as it's probably going to be their first major flop. That's what the predictions are on the internet at the moment.
Really, I think it'll make money. I mean, it'll do okay. It may not do Avengers business. Most of the films don't, but I'm sure it'll do as much money as say Ant-Man did. I think it made about $500 million. I imagine it's a lot of all their films are huge successes. They usually do quite well, some better than others, but I mean they're kind of fitting pieces in here, and this is another part of their cinematic universe, and they're going into the magical realm now. Very trippy effects. This sort of Doctor Strange, I think, started back in the 60s, so there is a strong trippy LSD element to it, and based upon the trailers, they've really captured that in the film. It's got a great cast. I mean, it's got Benedict Cumberbatch is playing Doctor Stephen Strange. Tilda Swinton's in the film. Chiwetel Ejiofor, I think that's pronounced. He's in there too. So as always with these Marvel movies, they've got in some cracking actors, some interesting talent behind the camera as well. A big budget, great effects team. I'm sure it'll definitely look weird and interesting. As long as it's entertaining at the end of the day, I mean, I'm going to go and see it on Tuesday night when it opens, and I'm quite looking forward to it. And that's obviously the reason why we got the Guardians of the Galaxy trailer, because it's going to tie in with the release of this film next week. And I noticed that Fox have also jumped on the bandwagon by putting out their first trailer for Logan, which is the new Wolverine movie that comes out next year. And that that's obviously a Marvel-related product, so they've brought out a trailer to tie in with it.
Another Wolverine movie. Have they not learnt from the last two?
Well, actually, The Wolverine, the second one, was, I thought, quite good. This one is based on the Old Man Logan comic book series, so it's an aging and no longer healing Wolverine, and an old and suffering from Alzheimer's Dr. Xavier, played by Patrick Stewart. And basically, this is Hugh Jackman's swan song. This is his last X-Men movie, his last time playing Wolverine. And he looked quite good in the trailers, actually, so I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds like X-Men Last of the Summer Wine.
Or the nursing home, yeah.
Do they travel down a steep hill in a bathtub at any stage?
Quite possibly. That's a good... if I do the review for that film, I'm going to use that line, Ed. That's excellent.
Yeah,
so this week it's Doctor Strange. That's the big opening. Most other films have kind of given this a bit of a wide berth this week, because Marvel do tend to dominate when they open.
Are you going to see it, Phil, with your unlimited card?
Don't be silly.
I just you know, was wondering idly if you might, you know, use the ability to go to the cinema for free.
Yeah, I think I'll get my money's worth come December. I think that's...
Go and see Rogue One 20 times.
Just resign to the fact you're not going between now and then.
No, I might get it at some point. I don't know.
I think of the upcoming films, there's one film I think you'll enjoy and you should go and see. It's Arrival. That looks really good and interesting. About the one where the aliens arrive and the woman has to, Amy Adams has to communicate with them. That looks really good. And Denis Verheyen, I think his name, who made Sicario and Prisoners, directed it, and is now currently making Blade Runner 2. I think that looks like a really interesting movie. I want to see that, definitely.
Right, so some people will still be buying Blu-rays. So what can they buy this week, Steve?
This week we've got quite a few releases, and quite a few of them are actually current or upcoming competition prizes as well. So this week we've got Gods of Egypt coming out on Blu-ray and 3D Blu-ray, and that's a competition prize. We actually reviewed this a few months ago because it came out on Ultra HD Blu-ray in the States a lot earlier. There's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows, which again opened in the States a bit earlier, so already Simon's reviewed the Ultra HD Blu-ray of this, but this is coming out on Blu-ray and UHD Blu-ray this week in the UK. We have The Man Who Fell to Earth, a new 4K restoration of one of my favourite films. Nicholas Rowe directed it. David Bowie's absolutely amazing, basically playing himself. And it's a really, really good film. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. I think it's fantastic. And that's had a 4K restoration. I've seen the new Blu-ray. Kaz has just reviewed it. It's also going to be a competition prize coming up. And I think it's an amazing film. And so if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's great. And the restoration is really good. It looks superb. Also, 1 Million Years BC, another 4K restoration done on this. I think both by Studio Canal. And again, I have seen this too. And the review's coming up. It's also going to be a competition prize. And if you're a Harryhausen fan, it's a cracking film. I mean, it's not a great movie, to be honest. The plot's very simplistic. Clearly, it's absolute rubbish in any kind of paleontological or historical sense. But you've got Rucka Welsh in a fur bikini, and you've got lots of dinosaurs and Ray Harryhausen. What more could you want? So that's available. And finally, there's Kids Return, which is the latest Blu-ray release of an older film from Beat Takeshi, which I know Kaz is a fan of. So if you're a fan of Japanese cinema, maybe Mark will probably know about, Takeshi Kitano. But that's coming out this week as well, and Kaz will be reviewing that.
Okay. Good stuff. And one thing I did notice this week, which really surprised me, was I was in Tesco Extra. It's a 24-hour store, Steve, but it's not like the big stores. It's kind of medium-sized one. So the entertainment section's not great. I mean, they only ever have a small Blu-ray section, and the rest, it's all DVD and that kind of thing. In there this week, they had 7 UHD Blu-rays for sale at £20 a disc. Was staggered to see that in such a store. So there you go, it's made it. It's finally there. It'll only last a few weeks, but you know, they have them and they were on the shelf.
But well, that is interesting, though, isn't it? So it's starting to creep into the mainstream. Given it only launched in April, I think that's not too bad, actually.
Yeah, well, like I say, it's maybe just there for the run-up to Christmas, or it's maybe just there for a week or two to see if they sell, and if they don't sell, they probably won't have them again. But at least they were there.
Take it when you can get it.
Yeah, so are they going to release anything decent on UHD Blu-ray, Steve?
Well, there's been quite a few announcements. Whether you'd consider them to be decent or not, I'm not entirely sure. But upcoming releases that have been announced now, so they've announced Jason Bourne, but they've also, along with that, they're releasing all the Bourne movies on Ultra HD Blu-ray, so the Bourne Identity, Bourne Supremacy, Bourne Ultimatum, and Bourne Legacy.
But then you could just buy the Bourne movie, because that's like a greatest hit, so you don't need to buy the rest.
Yeah. You could. You actually could do that. War Dogs is coming out. So Warners have announced War Dogs for 22nd of November.
I've seen that one.
The Bourne movie. You quite enjoyed it, didn't you?
Yeah, it was one of the ones I went and used my unlimited card. It was really quite funny.
Steady.
Back in August. War Dogs comes out on the 22nd of November, in the States at least. Jason Bourne, that actually comes out earlier in the UK than the US. So all the Bourne movies come out in the UK, I think it's the last week of November, and then they come out in the US the first week of December. Warners have announced a bunch of legacy titles. So I Am Legend, Goodfellas, and Argo are all getting released. But they've also got some newer stuff. Sully, nothing to do with Monsters, Inc. That'll be coming out on 20th of December in the States. And Sony Pictures have announced a couple of others. Again, these are legacy catalog titles. Underworld and Resident Evil Afterlife. So all the top titles are coming out at the moment.
And you'll buy every single one of them.
He will. He'll buy them.
And one thing I will say in Sony's defense is that they do put a lot of effort into these releases in terms of, you know, they all have Atmos mixes, even if they didn't have
one. They are fantastically well-polished turds. Beautifully. You can see your face in them.
Oh, that should be the strap line. And then at AV Forums, Ed Selly.
Fantastically well-polished turds.
But this is the thing, though, isn't it? You know, yes, Steve, they are. I'm delighted that they're putting the legwork in. It doesn't change the fundamental issue that the material itself, to start with, is just poor.
Given that Sony owned the rights to Taxi Driver and Close Encounters and Lawrence of Arabia, you know, which I know have all had 4K restorations, you do think, can you not put out some of the big titles, please? Give it a bit of a boost.
Yeah,
much as I quite enjoy Resident Evil movies, it's not like I was on top of my list of Ultra HD Blu-ray purchases.
Yeah, you would think they would do something, especially in the run-up to Christmas. You know, you'd think that, you know, some of those big name titles would be out there, but no, doesn't look like it.
But they do surprise. I mean, I was very. I mean, having seen The Shallows at the cinema, and I knew it was shot at about 3.4K resolution, but it was finished at 2K digital intermediate. It looked great at the cinema, and I was really gobsmacked at how much better it looked domestically on Ultra HD Blu-ray, where the addition of things like high dynamic range really added to it. And obviously it had Dolby Atmos soundtrack as well on the Ultra HD Blu-ray, which again was really good and really immersive in terms, particularly when she's out in the water and surfing or stuck on the little island. Fantastic. So it goes, when they do put the effort in, I think it is worth it. And I mean, I think The Shadows is a pretty good movie, and it really benefited from that. So, you know, but it would be nice to see them pull out some of the big guns too.
You and your big guns.
Also, it'd be nice to see Disney get involved in any form.
Yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, they have some of the biggest franchises ever in their camp.
They've got all the biggest franchises.
Yeah, so. Okay, so that's UHD Blu-ray Roundup. Interesting news last week. I think it was last week. Certainly last week in terms of recording the podcast. Netflix and Amazon. It's been reported that they're outspending most of the established broadcasters and networks in terms of investment in new programming. And when you look at the sums of money that they're talking about here, it's pretty staggering. I mean, $7.6 billion, I think, was mentioned as the actual spend between the two of them on new programming.
Yeah, it's very impressive, the amount of money they're spending now. I mean, and how quickly it's grown over the last 3 years. But in terms of Netflix in particular, I mean, they're spending just under $5 billion they spent just under $5 billion in 2015. So they presumably spent even more this year. And that puts them just behind CBS. So if you look at the three big US networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. They're just behind CBS. I mean, they're a long way behind ABC and NBC, who spend upwards of $10 billion a year. But growth from, I mean, you look at also look at CBS's spend. They've been the same each year for the last 3 years, but whereas obviously Netflix are growing exponentially. So they're going to be possibly the third network, effectively, this year. And Amazon aren't far behind. They've already outstripped HBO, and they're catching up with Turner. So, you know, that just shows you how big and how important streaming services are becoming, and how they're fundamentally changing, I think, the landscape of TV. I mean, for example, the day we're recording this, which is the Friday, Netflix have just put up 6 new episodes of Black Mirror, Charlie Brooker's show. So they've taken that from Channel 4. So that's I think that's a bit of a coup for them, at least in terms of the UK. They've been doing them. We talk about Disney/ABC being the biggest spender, but they obviously do productions with Netflix, because the Marvel series, Luke Cage, has just gone up a couple of weeks ago, which was excellent. So they're doing really good stuff. I mean, a lot of what I'm watching now is not broadcast. A lot of what I'm watching now is streamed. So I just wish I had a better internet connection.
But this is, if you like, an inevitability of what happens when an organization is able to budget for getting everything out to the world at the same time. You know, it's world programming to a worldwide audience, and there's none of the, you know, oh, are we going to be able to syndicate this to, you know, some shonky network in country X or country Y. It's like, we're going to make this, it's going to go live on this date, and we expect viewing figures that are incomprehensible, even when you compare it to the US domestic networks. This is the future. It's one of those things where this is, you know, you are looking at a sea change in broadcast TV. Well, I say broadcast in terms of non-cinema based material here. And Netflix and Amazon are reaping the same benefits that film companies are when they're, you know, big summer blockbusters go live in the same week, basically all around the world. And it's going to significantly alter, I think, how networks have to think about how they're going to do things. Yeah.
I mean, the other thing there, Ed, is that you're talking about, you know, film, when it goes live, you know, across the world, a big opening weekend. But there'll be, correct me if I'm wrong, but there'll be at least $100 million behind that in terms of promotion, Steve. If it's a big, big blockbuster that's opening worldwide over one weekend, the amount of PR and interviews and all the rest of it, and, you know, it'd be a huge spend. But if you look at stuff like Stranger Things and other series like Breaking Bad and so on, that was all word of mouth. There was very little in terms of advertising or big promotional spends behind those.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they don't have to do that. Or somehow they've managed to find a way of getting the viewers on. I mean, they don't actually publish their viewing numbers, do they, Netflix? And I'd be fascinated to see actually how many people did watch Stranger Things, for example, because there's no question it generated an awful lot of buzz and word of mouth. Whether that was amongst our little world and it reached out beyond that, I'm not entirely sure.
Oh, no, I've had family members and stuff saying the same thing to me. I mean, people who I would never put down as being technically minded enough to know what Netflix was. They have Netflix, they watch Netflix, and they've watched it. And, you know, these are people that I would never have suspected. So I think it's really quite a wide reach, to be honest, these days.
Steve, did you want to know something crazy? Vinyl Me Please, the web vinyl club that I've done some work for, they had the Stranger Things soundtrack done as a double vinyl. 2,000 copies, 7 minutes. That's how long they lasted.
Yeah, so I think if we were going back maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I think that statement would have been true, Steve. But I think nowadays, I mean, so many people are now switched on to Netflix and have Netflix in one form or another, whether through their TV or a media box or whatever, even on their PC or their laptops, or even on tablets. You know, I think the viewing audience there, it has to be huge. Just look at the sums of money that's being spent. I mean, they wouldn't be spending that if they didn't have that coming back in the door.
Mm. Yeah, true.
Sorry. Just thinking about this as well, it is also having some other, I'd say, very positive effects in terms of the lag between something showing in the States and now getting out to other locations is dropping all the time. I mean, obviously, I'm watching this current season of South Park I think it's 3 days behind the States. Westworld is 2 days. 20th year, and it's unbelievable. But yeah, and then and actually this season's really good. Just as an aside, it's got some really quite clever ideas going. And then obviously Westworld is now what, 48 hours behind, when obviously Game of Thrones is 24 and so on and so forth. There's none of this sitting around with your thumb up somewhere unfortunate whilst it's been out in the States, being pirated to death. It's, you know, they know they can't do that anymore. It's out in the States, and it's showing imminent and quickly in the UK and other locations as well.
I think their hand's been kind of forced in that respect as well, though. Certainly Netflix, you know, from using VPN and going and using the US service and all that kind of thing, they really tried to cut back on that. And I think the way they had to cut back on people doing that, because they have to satisfy different licenses and so on, was to try and bring all that content together. So it didn't matter what region you were in, you know, that content was available to you straight away. I think that's one way that they have managed to fight back on the VPN thing, because I used to use VPN a hell of a lot. And I know you did, Stephen, and I don't use it now because I'm satisfied enough that I've got enough there on the UK service. I don't need to go elsewhere.
I've got too much as it is, more than I can watch. So I tell you what, I mean, I think Hodge has made this point a few times in the past, and I agree with him now. It has fundamentally changed the way that I consume television. I find it difficult now, for example, with Westworld, to watch an episode, wait a week, watch the next one. You know, I prefer the option of just watching a couple of episodes and then, you know, maybe binging it over a weekend if I've got the time, which I did, for example, with Luke Cage. And I might do with Black Mirror, depending on how good the first episode is. So that's kind of changed my approach. You know, I expect it to be there and I can watch it when I want to watch it. And the idea of having to wait for it to be broadcast on a specific time each week. I know you could watch it afterwards on catch-up service, etc., but that idea just seems antiquated to me now.
I think it's one of the reasons why they're able to do this and spend this money is that it's all just going towards building a catalogue of titles, you know, so it kind of creates this critical mass to the point where people then subscribe. So it's not just a case of broadcasting something, having to push huge amounts of advertising money towards getting people to tune in at that point, and then trying to ascertain how many people actually watched it. It gives kind of a content time to be kind of slow burn. You know, there's no pressure. If you miss an episode, I mean, if there's something big or something on, you know, a major channel that you miss, if you miss like the opening episode or two, then you think, well, I don't know whether I can get into this now. With streaming, you just always have that option. So it just kind of continually builds that catalog. So it almost feels like there's no real sense of wasted money. You know, it's there and it's always kind of at your fingertips for when you want it.
Interesting is how Netflix and also Amazon are making not their own shows necessarily, but other people's shows available to a wider audience. Because you mentioned Breaking Bad. People forget Breaking Bad wasn't broadcast in this country. If you want to see Breaking Bad, you basically bought it on disc. It wasn't until the last season that Netflix started showing it in the UK the day after it was shown in the States. And they did the same thing with Better Call Saul. And they're going to be doing exactly the same thing in January. Oh, no, it's been delayed, hasn't it, till May. In May with Star Trek. So they're actually giving us access to shows that we wouldn't have had a chance to see otherwise. Because for some reason, I mean, the first season of Agent Carter, a Marvel series, ended up being on Netflix because no one broadcast it in the UK, which I found it amazing when you consider that it's a Marvel series. But for some reason, it didn't get broadcast. The second season got broadcast on Fox via you know, via Sky. But first season, you couldn't watch it unless you accessed it via Netflix.
I guess
so. That's good.
I guess that could also point, though, Steve, to reduced budgets when it comes to domestic broadcasters. They maybe don't have the clout that they used to have in terms of buying US shows and so on to you know, syndicate.
It's true. That's very true as well. And also there's been that annoying habit, and it's happened a few times, where someone takes a chance on a show, like maybe it's Channel 4 or the BBC, and they buy the first season. It does really well, and then Sky jump in and pick it up for the second or third seasons, and it disappears off the satellite. People can't see it anymore. That's always a bit annoying. But I do like, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Netflix and Amazon, but particularly Netflix, I do think they generate some really, really quality content. And I think, you know, they are, they're changing the game. It's as simple as that. And it's going to be fascinating to see what happens over the next 5 years in terms of television generally.
Okay, to wrap up, let's move to a bit of a musical ending to the podcast, Guardians of the Galaxy. I'll call it Guardians. So they use lots of 70s and 80s songs in the soundtrack. I've got to say, it was one of the better curated soundtracks of the recent past. You know, I think you'd have to go back to something like Pulp Fiction, or certainly the way Tarantino uses music in movies. I don't think there's a great deal of other films out there that kind of do that, other than Guardians of the Galaxy. But I could be wrong. Prove me wrong, Steve.
Well, I think it's strange how the use of pop music in movies was a relatively unknown thing until American Graffiti. And George Lucas, who was the first person to really use pop music as a continuous soundtrack to a film, having it playing in the background, and not just, you know, via a radio or record player in a scene, but you know, was using it in the background as a score effectively. So that was groundbreaking at the time. I mean, it seems obvious now, but it was genuinely groundbreaking back in 73. And someone pointed out that if he tried to make that film again now, the cost of the soundtrack would be like $100 million or something insane like that. You know, you couldn't afford to use all those songs, but he had Elvis songs and all kinds of songs. But back then, paying for the movie rights to use them in a film was relatively cheap, because no one had thought of that being something that you'd want to do anyway. Songs were generally written for a film. You didn't just use existing soundtracks. So that was the first one that stands out. And then more recently, you've already mentioned it, Phil, but Tarantino has, frankly, excellent taste in music, I think, and does pick some interesting and often quite obscure songs for his soundtracks, and can sort of re-energize someone's career in a way that couldn't before. So I think Danny Boyle did it quite well in Trainspotting. I mean, it's impossible to hear Lust for Life now without thinking of the opening scene of Trainspotting. But it is certainly Guardians of the Galaxy was one of the first films in recent memory where you thought they've put together a really good soundtrack for this film, and made you want to go and buy it and listen to it.
You end up these days, other than Tarantino, actually there's still a score, and then there's some brought in tracks, and sometimes they're released as a single piece of music where you've got so on and so forth. I mean, Rush is an example of this. It's got a Zimmer score, and then it's got some, you know, music of the 74 to 76 era to sort of, you know, add other elements to it. It's comparatively rare to find a Guardians of the Galaxy style thing where it's much more still relying almost exclusively on brought in music. Although obviously it still has a score as well when I think about it, so maybe it's not so unusual. I was trying to think about this when I saw it on the running order. Other than Tarantino, obviously the early Fast and Furious films didn't really make use of a score in the meaningful sense of the word. They used stuff that was brought in. And one of my favourite film soundtracks of this nature, does anyone else remember Go?
Yeah, absolutely loved
it. Yeah, great film.
Yeah.
That has a truly stonking soundtrack. Really, really good. A compilation album that stands up very nicely in its own right. Very, very good indeed. And it probably cost you at least £1 on eBay. well worth getting in there. That was a really fine example for me. Another film that mixed non-original film content with a score quite effectively. The first two Matrix films did very well at that. The third one, not so much. The first Matrix soundtrack, that was very, very good. It had the sort of weird, you know, accented string sort of score, but then it used some really quite good tracks that I thought captured the sort of nature of the film quite nicely.
But what are you talking about? There was only one Matrix film, wasn't there?
You've done that, have you? You've retconned it.
Purged it from your memory.
Totally. The other director who I think has a fantastic musical taste and uses it within his films, and that's Danny Boyle. Whether it's Slumdog Millionaire, where he's using traditional music and westernising it to fit with his score, or something like Trainspotting, set in the 80s, early 90s.
Martin Scorsese is another director who's got a great ear for using pop music in his films. from back, right back to Mean Streets when they used, I think it's Be My Baby in that. And obviously there's a fantastic scene where he actually timed the camera moves to the second half of Layla, the piano piece, as the camera moves in on all the bodies that De Niro's killing to shut them up after the robbery. That's fantastic. And he actually had it playing on set as they moved the camera in time to the music. So he's got it. And also, you've mentioned something already, Phil, Stranger Things. Each episode ends with a cracking song, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
not necessarily period, but in some way connected to what's happened in the episode. I thought was really clever. I loved their use of Peter Gabriel's cover of Heroes, for example, which is, I thought was fantastic at the end of one of the episodes. Mm,
yeah.
That was really clever.
Drive.
Yeah, although people overestimate how many tracks are actually were extant before Drive used them. I mean, a huge amount of the stuff that people pay attention to is the Clint Martinez score, and then quite a few of the other tracks in it had sort of either not been released or existed in any other form other than Drive. There's only about six songs used in it that aren't the Clint Martinez score when you actually sort of listen back through it. But it works beautifully for the film itself, no question.
I enjoyed Moulin Rouge, where they took existing songs and reworked them.
I was just about to say that, Steve. Moulin Rouge. That wasn't.
Hate that. I hate it on a level I can't even begin to put into words.
It is such a fantastic film.
I've just found a staple gun on my wife's desk, and I would sooner shoot every staple in it into my scrotum than watch that film again.
It wasn't that bad. I agree with you, dreadful. Steve. It's absolutely brilliant use of lyrics to actually tell the story as it was going along, and the whole elephant medley thing was brilliant. Mm-hmm. Really, really good. Really good.
I remember when I saw it at the cinema, the first 10 minutes are quite in your face. The whole, you know, the whole the nightclub scenes and everything, and it is a little over the top. The whole can stuff, and I thought, Christ, if it's going to be like this for the next 2 hours, I don't think I can take this because this is just too over the top and in my face. But obviously, after that, it calmed down, and actually, by the end of it, I absolutely loved the film. I thought it was fantastic, and it is quite common. It was pretty common in the 30s and 40s to use existing pop songs and rework them into a film. And I mean, for example, you know, a classic film that's now associated completely with the song, but it was an existing song only, is Time Goes By in Casablanca. But they've done it loads and loads of times with other films. Films will be written for one film and then used in another film. And so what Baz Luhrmann did was kind of a throwback to that kind of idea of taking existing songs like a Virgin. And I think the Like a Virgin sequence is one of the funniest things. It's like it's like a Monty Python sketch, but without Monty Python. It's really funny. Yeah, Jim Broadbent's excellent in it.
It's like an old MGM grand musical set piece, though, isn't it? The way it's really fantastic. I mean, I think it's one of them. And I can see where Ed's coming from. You either love it or you hate it.
I loathe it. But I will say, just so I don't have a massive downer on Baz Luhrmann, he did. He used an almost completely, music artist-based score for his Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, one of my favorite.
That was very, very good.
One of my favorite albums.
And the only song that was sort of done for it, as I understand it, it's a bit of a complicated one because they used Talk Show Host by Radiohead, which hadn't actually prior to that gone or been used anywhere else. But other than that, it's just standard stuff that had already existed.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favourite albums. In fact, it's there's two volumes for that because the soundtrack was so encompassing.
Didn't they write Come What May for Romeo and Juliet? I think there was some reason why Come What May was not nominated for an Oscar. I think it would have won otherwise, but it was because it had been written previously for another film. In this case, I think Romeo and Juliet, but they didn't use it in Romeo and Juliet, and they recorded it for Moulin Rouge. But for some reason, that meant it wasn't eligible for nomination for best song in a film.
Yeah, I mean, Craig Armstrong's work on all those soundtracks, because he worked really closely with Baz Luhrmann for a long time. Absolutely brilliant. If you ever, I don't know if you've picked up any of his actual albums, Ed. Craig Armstrong.
I've got all of them as far as I know.
Have you got? Yeah, even his standalone albums are absolutely brilliant. But his scoring and some of the tracks that he did for Romeo and Juliet and what was the other one?
Strictly Ballroom.
Strictly Ballroom, yeah. He did stuff for that as well. And he did stuff for Moulin Rouge. He did a lot of orchestration stuff on your song and some of those cues are absolutely brilliant. Really, really good.
Speaking of Baz Luhrmann and Netflix, has anyone seen The Get Down yet?
No, not yet.
That looks interesting. I mean, it's just too much on at the moment. There's just too much choice. Where to start?
Is that the one with Grandmaster Flash? The Get Down. Yeah, I keep meaning to watch that, and I can't get around to it. But yeah, I mean, you'll enjoy that, Ed. Beginning of the 70s, late 70s, beginning of the whole hip hop DJ culture and that kind of thing.
I'll really put it on my enormous list of things to do.
Yeah, same here.
But no.
Same here.
I think the problem with using music in films was that it became, it was an original idea in the 70s. I think Lucas, as I say, was probably the first person to really take it to that level of using it as a way of creating a soundtrack. Scorsese used it quite a bit. And then the record companies and film studios began to realize there was money to be made in this. And then it became less of an artistic choice that song would really fit that scene, and more about, we're going to curate a series of songs for this film. We're going to put them on a soundtrack. They might not even appear, or they'll only be a few seconds in the background of a scene, but it's going to be on the soundtrack album, and that'll sell shed loads. Things like the Pulp Fiction album, obviously, I mean, that was a series of songs that were integral to the film and were chosen by Scorsese, Tarantino, but the album sold really, really well. And I think the record companies and studios started seeing dollar bills, and it became less a creative process and more about making money, like everything else, I suppose. Money ruined it in the end.
You mentioned Tarantino, and the one I think keeps getting forgotten about is Reservoir Dogs, which is a radio playing in the background, because they're in that warehouse, and it's the radio that's playing in the background, and it's Steve Wright, the US comedian, who's pretending to be the DJ in between the tracks, and that was really, really clever, the way they did that and put that soundtrack together.
Yeah, that was clever on many levels, wasn't it? The way that he didn't have very much budget, so he picked really obscure songs that were cheap to buy.
Yeah.
Had it in the radio in the background in a single location. It all tied together perfectly, didn't it, in terms of, as a creative choice. Again, it was a creative decision.
Then you're back to Guardians of the Galaxy with regards to the tape player, aren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Awesome. Yeah. Mm. And the way that the second film is now called Volume 2, to tie in with the whole mixtape thing.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. You see? Tape is the format that's going to make it, Ed, not vinyl, into the future.
Hey, reel to reel. That's the if you want the most awkward way of listening to your music imaginable, reel to reel is making a big comeback. It's only about £175 an album, so it's a nice, accessible everyman sort of way of doing things.
Yeah,
I'm still waiting for 8-track to make a comeback.
I used to use reel to reel quite a bit. I learned to edit on a reel to reel with a splice bar, a Stanley knife, and some tape. That was editing back in the day, I tell you.
Well, given the way that Skype's working at the moment, perhaps we should revisit that.
Well, I mean, the only other solution is to have us all in the same room, and can you imagine what a disaster that would be?
Where on earth would we meet?
Let's meet in Vegas.
See how that goes.
It could literally be four blokes down the pub talking then, couldn't it?
I was thinking more of some kind of a self-help group. We'll meet someday.
A padded cell. Good acoustics.
And on that therapeutical bombshell, that's it for the podcast this week. My thanks to Ed Selly.
We're all standing now. Bunch of jackasses standing in a circle.
Mark Buttright.
We're just like Kevin Bacon.
And Steve Withers.
I need his prosthetic leg.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark AV forums for latest reviews, news and video, and of course, leave us those 5-star ratings on iTunes, but only if you enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.